Killed by the neighborhood watch guy?
Kessler said.
Same first name, yeah. What, you never met no one else named Caleb before? Well, sure. Then...
Kessler raised his eyebrows, waited.
Trayvon's just a less common name. Where you're from?
Rachel couldn't stand another fucking second of this. Detective, why are you looking for my husband?
We just want to ask him a couple of questions.
You're from Rhode Island?
Yes, ma'am. Providence, PD. These wonderful officers are serving as my liaisons.
What does my husband have to do with something in Providence? She was pleasantly surprised with how effortlessly she slipped into the role of the befuddled wife.
You got a mouse under your eye,
Kessler said to Caleb.
Excuse me?
Kessler pointed, and now Rachel could see it too, a red welt in the fold of Caleb's right lower eyelid, growing angrier as they watched.
Look at that, Officer Mullen.
The blonde cop stooped a bit to get a better look.
How'd you happen to come by that, sir?
An umbrella,
Caleb said.
An umbrella? Officer Garza said. It jump out and bite you?
No, a guy had one on the tee when I was coming over here. I work in Cambridge. Anyway, he had it resting on his shoulder, and we came to his stop, and he turned real quick, and it poked me in the eye. Ouch,
Kessler said.
Exactly. Had to hurt twice as much when you think how little rain there's been this week. I mean, the beginning of the month, sure, that was crazy. But lately? When's the last time it rained?
He asked the room.
10 days, easy, Officer Mullen said.
Fuck's this guy doing carrying an umbrella, then?
Again, Kessler spoke to no one in particular, a bewildered smile on his lean face.
Excuse the F-bomb,
he said to Rachel.
No problem.
Crazy world we live in. Dudes walking around subway cars with umbrellas when there ain't no rain.
He looked at the bottles and glasses on the bar again.
So your husband is in Russia?
Yes. He turned to Caleb, who was clearly hoping he wouldn't.
And you came by to drop something off?
Hmm? Caleb said.
No. Business papers or something like that? No.
Caleb said.
So, I mean, stop me if I'm being too personal here. No, no. But why are you here? Man's out of the country and you just drop by to get your drink on with his wife?
Officer Mullen cocked an eyebrow at that. Officer Garza wandered around the living room. Rachel said,
We're all friends, Detective. My husband, Caleb, and me. Whatever antiquated notions you're bringing in here about whether a man and a woman can hang out as good friends while her husband is away, I'd really like it if you parked those notions somewhere outside these walls.
Kessler leaned back a bit, gave her a wide smile.
Well, all right.
The words rode a soft chuckle out of his mouth.
All right. I stand corrected. And I apologize for any offense I may have given.
She nodded. He handed her a photograph. One look, and the blood rushed along her hairline and behind her eyes and barreled through her heart. Brian sat with his arm around the pregnant woman she'd seen this afternoon. She wasn't pregnant in the picture, and Brian's hair had less gray in it than it did now. They were sitting on a couch. It had gray cushions and looked to be made of white rattan that blended with the white beadboard wall behind them. It was the kind of wall you found in a beach house, or, at the very least, a house in a beach town. Above them hung a reproduction of Monet's water lilies. Brian appeared very tan. He and the woman sported big, white smiles. She wore a blue flower-print summer dress. He wore a red flannel shirt and cargo shorts. Her left hand lay quite casually on his right thigh.
"You don't look well suddenly, ma'am,"
she said. How am I supposed to look, Detective, when you hand me a photograph of my husband and another woman? He held out his hand.
Can I have it back?
She handed it to him.
Do you know her?
She shook her head.
Never seen her before.
No.
How about you?
He handed the photograph to Caleb.
Know this woman? No. No? No,
Caleb said.
Well, you've missed your chance.
Trayvon Kessler returned the photograph to the pocket of his car coat.
She turned up dead about 8 hours ago.
Rachel said, How?
Shot once in the heart, once in the head. It probably led the news tonight if you've been watching.
He gave the bar another glance.
But you were engaged in other activities.
Who was she? Rachel asked.
Her name was Nicole Alden. Beyond that, I don't know much. No criminal record, no known enemies, worked in a bank. Knew your husband, though.
That picture's old, she told him. Might even predate when I met my husband. So what's to say he's still in contact with her?
You say he's in Russia?
Yeah. She found her phone, opened the last text he'd sent her, claiming to be on the runway at Logan. She showed it to Kessler. Kessler read it and handed the phone back.
He drive himself to the airport or take a cab?
He drove himself.
In the Infiniti?
Yes. She stopped. How do you know—
What he drives?
Yes.
Because an Infiniti FX-45, registered to your husband at this address, was found parked across the street from the victim's home this afternoon. And a witness saw your husband exit the home on or around the time of the murder.
And what, he just walked away and left his car behind?
Can we all sit down?
He tilted his head at the bar. All five of them took stools around the bar, Kessler in the middle, like the father at a family meeting.
Our witness says your husband drove up in the Infiniti, but he drove off again an hour later in a blue Honda. You ever use one of those map programs where you can see the actual street? Either of you?
They both nodded.
What the map companies do to get that picture is drive around in a van and film the streets. So you're looking at pictures could be months old or weeks, but not years. So I went on a real estate site, and I punched in the victim's address, and then I went to Street View, and I clicked around a bit. And guess what I found? A blue Honda,
Caleb said.
A blue Honda parked halfway down the block on the east side of the street. Got me a license plate, ran that plate, and discovered it was registered to a Brian Alden. Ran Mr. Alden through the DMV, got a driver's license photo that looks identical to your husband.
Jesus, Rachel said, not having to bring much to the performance to make it convincing. You're telling me my husband is not my husband.
I'm telling you your husband may be living a couple of lives, ma'am, and I'd like to talk to him about that.
He folded his hands on the bar and smiled at her.
Among other things.
After a minute, she said, I only know he's in Russia. Trayvon Kessler shook his head.
He's not in Russia.
I only know what he tells me.
And that's looking like it could be a lot of lies, ma'am. He go on business trips a lot?
At least once a month.
Where to?
Canada and the Pacific Northwest, mostly. But he also goes to India, Brazil, the Czech Republic, the United Kingdom.
Some cool places there. You ever go with him?
No.
Why not? I'd like to see me some real, maybe walk around Prague.
I have a condition.
A condition?
Or, I mean, I had one until recently. She could feel them all looking at her, particularly the two female cops, wondering what condition could possibly afflict an entitled Back Bay princess like her. It kept me from leaving the house, she said. I couldn't fly, that's for sure.
So you're afraid of flying?
Kessler's tone was helpful. Among other things.
You agoraphobic?
He said. She looked in his eyes, and they were far too wise.
I majored in psychology at Penn.
Again with the helpful tone of voice. It's never been officially diagnosed, she said eventually, and thought she heard Officer Mullins sigh. But I definitely had symptoms that suggested it.
Had? Past tense?
Brian's been working with me on it.
But not enough to take you on a business trip.
Not yet, no.
Would you like protective custody?
He said it so casually it took her a moment to process the words. Why would I want that? He turned on his stool.
Officer Garza, you got that other picture?
Garza handed him a photograph, and he turned it face up on the bar so she and Caleb could see it. The blonde woman lay face down on a kitchen floor, her lower half out of frame. Blood had billowed out from under her chest and pooled above her left shoulder. Her left cheek and part of the refrigerator door were also splattered with blood. But the worst image, the one Rachel suspected she'd be woken up by for the rest of her life, was the black gouge at the top of her head. It didn't look like someone had shot her. It looked like something had taken a bite out of her skull, and the hole left in the wake of that bite had immediately filled with blood that spilled into her hair and turned black.
If your husband did this, and—
My husband didn't do that, she said loudly.
I'm not saying he did, but he's the last person we know of to see her alive, so let's just say, Mrs. Delacroix, that he did do this?
He turned on his bar stool and pointed.
Well, ma'am, he has a key to that door.
He's beyond using it, she thought. She said, So you'd like to take me into your custody?
Protective custody, ma'am, protective.
Rachel shook her head.
Officer Mullen, please make note that Mrs. Delacroix declined our recommendation of PC.
Got it. Mullen scribbled on a pad. Kessler tapped a finger on the marble bar top as if testing it, then looked at her again.
Will you be willing to come down to the precinct and talk about when you last saw your husband?
The last time I saw Brian was 8 o'clock this morning when he drove himself to the airport.
He didn't drive himself to the airport.
So you say, that doesn't mean you're right. He gave that a small shrug.
But I am.
He exuded equal parts serenity and skepticism. The odd mixture made her feel as if he knew all her answers before they left her mouth. As if not only could he see into her, he could see into the future. He knew how this was going to end. It was all she could do to hold his mildly curious gaze and not fall to her knees and beg for mercy. If she ever went into an interview room with this man, the only way she'd exit would be in handcuffs. I'm tired, Detective. I'd like to get into bed and wait for my husband's phone call from Moscow. He nodded and patted her hand.
Officer Mullen, please make a note that Mrs. Delacroix declined to join us at the precinct to answer further questions.
He reached into the inside pocket of his car coat and placed his business card on the bar between them.
My personal cell is on the back.
Thank you. He stood.
Mr. Perloff.
His voice was suddenly louder and sharper, though he kept his back to Caleb.
Yes? When's the last time you saw Brian Delacroix? Yesterday afternoon, when he left work.
Kessler turned to him.
You're in the lumber business together, correct? Yes. And you knew nothing about your business partner's other life? No. Care to come to the precinct and speak about that at length? I'm pretty tired, too.
Another short glance at the bar, followed by a slightly longer one at Rachel.
Of course you are.
Kessler handed Caleb one of his business cards.
I'll call you,
Caleb said.
Yes, you will, Mr. Perloff. Yes, you will. Because can I tell you something? Sure. If Brian Delacroix slash Alden is as dirty as I think he is?
He leaned into Caleb and spoke in a whisper loud enough for all of them to hear.
Then that means you're fucking dirty, my man.
He slapped Caleb hard on the shoulder and laughed like they were old friends.
So you stay in plain sight now, hear?
Officer Mullen jotted in her notepad as they headed for the door. Officer Garza moved her head on a slow swivel, as if everything she saw was transmitted to a central database. Detective Kessler paused at a Rothko reprint Brian had brought with him from his previous apartment. Kessler gave the painting a squint, and then a soft smile, looked back at her, and raised his eyebrows in approval of her taste. His smile broadened, and man, she did not like what she saw there. They let themselves out. Caleb went straight to the bourbon.
Jesus,
he said.
Jesus.
Calm down. We've got to run. Are you nuts? You heard what he said.
All we've got to do is get to the money.
What money?
The money.
He drained his glass.
So much money, these fucking guys, they'll never catch us. Get the money. Get to the safe house. Jesus. Shit. Fuck.
He opened his mouth to loose another expletive, but then closed it. His eyes widened and welled.
Nicole? Not Nicole.
She watched him. He pressed the heel of his hand to each of his lower eyelids and exhaled through pursed lips.
Not Nicole,
he said again. So you knew her? He glared at her.
Of course I did.
Who was she?
She was...
Another long exhale.
She was my friend. She was a good person. And now she's...
He shot her another heartless glare.
Fucking Brian. I told him not to wait. I told him you'd either catch up or you wouldn't. We'd either send for you when it was safe or he'd forget about you.
Wait a minute, she said. Me? What were you waiting for me to... The doorbell rang. She looked at the door and noticed Trayvon Kessler's half-fedora sitting on the chair beside it. She crossed the condo and picked it up, had it in her hand when she opened the door. But it wasn't Detective Kessler on the other side of the threshold. It was two white men who looked like actuaries or mortgage brokers, middle-aged, bland, forgettable, except for the guns in their hands. Chapter 25. What Key? Each man held a 9mm Glock in front of his groin, their hands crossed at the wrists, barrels pointed at the ground. If anyone passed in the hall, they'd see only the men, not the guns.
Mrs. Delacroix, the one on the left said. Good to see you. May we come in?
He flicked the gun barrel toward her, and she stepped back. They came into the apartment and shut the door behind them. Caleb said,
Who the fucker?
And then saw the guns. The shorter of the two, the one who'd spoken, pointed his at Rachel's chest. The taller one pointed his at Caleb's head. He used it to gesture toward the dining room table.
Let's all have a seat over there, the shorter one said.
Rachel immediately saw the logic. Of all the places in the apartment, the dining area was the farthest from any windows. The only way you could see it from the front door was to enter the apartment, close the door behind you, and then look to your left. They sat at the table. Rachel placed Detective Kessler's hat on the table in front of her because she had no idea what else to do with it. Her throat closed up. Fire ants scuttled along her bones and crawled over her scalp. The shorter man had sad eyes and a sadder comb-over. He was about 55 and paunchy, wore a fraying white polo shirt under a sky-blue, members-only jacket, the kind that had been ubiquitous when Rachel was in grade school, but which she hadn't seen much of since. His partner was maybe 5 years younger. He had a full head of gray hair and fashionable gray stubble on his cheeks and chin. He wore a black t-shirt under a black sport coat that was a size too big for him and looked to be cheaply made. The shoulders spiked at the ends from spending too much time on wire hangers, and in between the spikes and the corresponding lapels lay a poppy field of dandruff. Both men gave off a whiff of curdled dreams and dead ambitions. That's probably how they ended up here, Rachel thought, threatening ordinary citizens with guns. The one in the members-only jacket, she decided, looked like a Ned. The one with the dandruff, she dubbed Lars. She'd hoped humanizing them would reduce her terror, but it actually had the reverse effect, particularly once Ned screwed a silencer onto the muzzle of his Glock and Lars followed suit.
We, Ned said, are pressed for time, so I'm going to ask you both to look after your best interests and not go down the I-don't-know-what-you're-talking-about route. Fair enough?
Rachel and Caleb stared at him. He pinched the bridge of his nose, closed his eyes for a moment.
I said, fair enough?
Yes, Rachel said.
Yes,
Caleb said. Ned looked at Lars, and Lars looked at Ned, and then they both went back to looking at Rachel and Caleb.
Rachel,
Ned said.
It is Rachel, right?
Rachel could hear the tremor in her voice when she answered.
Yes.
Rachel, he said, stand up for me.
What?
Stand up for me, hon. Really, just right here in front of me.
She stood, and the tremor that had been in her voice found her legs. Ned's nose, red-veined and pitted, was eye-level with her belly.
Good, good. Stay right there now, and don't move.
Okay.
Ned leaned back in his chair so he could get a clear look at Caleb.
You're his partner, right?
Caleb said.
Whose?
Ned tapped the butt of the Glock on the table.
What did we say about that? Oh, Brian,
Caleb said quickly.
Brian's partner, yes.
Ned rolled his eyes at Lars.
Oh, Brian. Oh, that Brian,
Lars said. Ned gave it a rueful smile.
So, Caleb, where's the key?
Caleb said.
What key?
Ned punched Rachel in the stomach, punched her so hard she could feel the impression of his knuckles as they burrowed under her windpipe and lifted her off her feet. She landed on the floor and lay there, stripped of oxygen, her insides aflame, her mind filled with black gum, unable to process anything. And once she could process, around the time that the air returned to her lungs, the pain intensified. She ground her head into the floor and made it to her hands and knees. She gasped several times, but the pain was nothing compared to the realization that she was going to die tonight. Not soon, not someday, probably in the next 5 minutes, and definitely tonight. Ned lifted her to her feet. He grasped her shoulders. He seemed worried she might collapse.
You okay?
She nodded, and for a moment was sure she was going to vomit.
Say it.
His eyes searched hers. Ned, the Good Samaritan.
I'm okay.
Good.
He went to sit down, but he held her upright.
I'm sorry,
he said.
But we may have to go again.
She couldn't stop the tears. She tried, she did, but she was overwhelmed by the memory of his knuckles, of the loss of breath, of pain so acute and immediate it short-circuited her ability to think, and worst of all, the advance knowledge that it was coming, that this sad-eyed man with the comb-over and the concerned voice would hit her again and keep hitting until he got what he wanted or she was dead, whichever came first.
"Shh,"
Ned said.
"Turn around. I want him to see your face."
He put his hands on her shoulders and turned her so that she was facing Caleb.
"My first punch, young man, was to her solar plexus. Hurts like hell, but it's not all that harmful to your health. My next punch will blow up her fucking kidneys." "I don't know anything." "Sure you do. You're the IT guy. You were part of this from the beginning. Brian went rogue." "He did, huh?"
Caleb's eyes danced. His face was covered in sweat, and his lips twitched, and he looked for all the world to see like the frightened boy she now realized he'd always been. He glanced at Rachel, and at first she mistook the emotion in his eyes for empathy, but then realized, to her horror, that it was embarrassment, shame, pity. He was ashamed because he knew he'd never have the courage to save her. He pitied her, because he knew she was going to die. "He's going to pulverize my kidneys, Caleb. Tell him what you know." Ned ran the silencer down the side of Rachel's right temple and then along her neckline.
"Don't make me do this, young man. I got a daughter. I got sisters."
Caleb said,
"Look." "There's no look, Caleb. There's no, hang on a second, or let me explain, or this is just a big misunderstanding."
Ned inhaled deeply through his nostrils, a man trying to retain his cool.
"There's only a question and an answer. That's it."
Rachel felt his penis stiffen against the back of her left hip. He was hard, this father of a daughter, this brother of sisters. Monsters, her mother had told her, and she had learned herself over the years, don't dress like monsters. They dress like humans. Even stranger, they rarely know they're the monsters.
"Where's the key?"
Ned said.
"What key?"
Caleb said, his entire face quivering. It stopped quivering when Ned fired a bullet into it. She wasn't sure what had happened at first. She registered the slap of the bullet entering flesh. She heard Caleb make a surprised yelp, the last sound, it turned out, he'd ever make. His head snapped back hard, as if he'd just heard the funniest of jokes. His head snapped forward, except now it was covered in a beaded curtain of blood, and Rachel opened her mouth to scream. Ned placed the silencer to the side of her neck. It was hot enough to burn if he left it there too long.
"If you scream, I have to kill you. I don't want to kill you, Rachel."
But he would. "No, Rachel, he will. The moment they're done here, the moment they get whatever it is they want, a key. What fucking key? Brian had so many keys on his keyring that it would take a mathematical savant to notice he'd added one. But if he did have this key they were looking for, that's where it probably was, on his keyring, which was on his person, which was sitting at the bottom of Massachusetts Bay. Caleb's corpse slipped sideways in the chair and would have slid all the way to the floor, but his shoulder wedged underneath the arm. For a moment, the only sound came from him dripping.
"So, the answer you want to give my next question," Ned said, "is definitely not what key."
"No matter what answer you give, he will kill you." She nodded.
"Are you nodding because you have my answer, or because you agree that saying what key would be a big mistake?"
He took the gun away from her neck.
"You can talk. I know you're not going to scream."
"What am I supposed to say?"
On the other side of the table, Lars stood, clearly bored, ready to leave, and that was far more unsettling than if he'd tried to be menacing. What was happening here was coming to a close, and the period on the sentence would be another bullet to another face, this time hers.
"So here we go," Ned said. "Only one answer we're looking for, and that'd be the right one."
"Rachel," he said with the utmost delicacy and concern,
"where's the key?"
"Brian has it."
"And where's Brian?"
"I don't know," she said, and then, rushing, as Ned raised his gun, "but I have an idea."
"An idea?"
"He has a boat. Nobody knows about it."
"What's the name of it, and where is it moored?"
She'd never seen the name. She'd never thought to look. She said,
"It's moored..."
The doorbell rang. They all looked at the door, then at one another, then back at the door.
"Who would that be?"
Ned asked.
"I haven't a clue."
"Your husband?"
"He wouldn't ring the bell."
The bell rang again, followed by a knock on the door.
"Mrs. Delacroix, it's Detective Kessler." "Detective Kessler?"
Ned tried the words out.
"Huh."
"I forgot my hat, ma'am."
Ned and Rachel both looked down at the half fedora Rachel had placed on the table. Another knock, insistent, the knock of a man used to knocking on doors whether the people on the other side wanted him to come in or not.
"Mrs. Delacroix?"
"Coming!"
Rachel called. Ned shot her a look. Rachel shot him a look back. "What did you want me to do?" Ned and Lars looked at each other. Whatever telepathic language they spoke, they arrived at a decision. Ned handed her the hat. He raised his palm in front of her face.
"You see the width of my hand?"
"Yes."
"That's how far you open the door. And then you give him his hat, and you close it."
She started to step away from him, but he grabbed her arm at the elbow and turned her to face Caleb. The blood curtain on his face was darkening. If this were Haiti, his head would be covered with flies.
"If you deviate from my instructions one iota, I do that to you."
She started to shake, and he spun her toward the door.
"Stop shaking,"
he whispered.
"How?"
Her teeth chattered. He slapped her hard on the ass. She looked back at him, and he gave her a small smile because the shakes had stopped.
"Now you've learned a new trick."
She took the hat and crossed her apartment. To the left of the door, on a hook, was her bag, a mini shoulder bag, brown leather, a Christmas gift from Brian. She put her hand on the doorknob and decided what she was going to do as she was doing it, not giving herself time to think, not giving them time to think. She opened the door past the recommended 2 to 3 inches, opened it so that Detective Trayvon Kessler had a clear angle past her left shoulder, could see the hallway that led to the bedrooms, the half-bathroom door, the kitchen bar. She pulled her bag off the hook, crossed the threshold, and handed him his hat, pretty much all in the same motion. The bullet entered her back, cut her spine in half, spewed the bone chips into her bloodstream as she collapsed into Detective Kessler. The fall kept him from clearing his own gun. Ned kept firing, shot Kessler in the head and the shoulder and the arm. He fell with Rachel. They landed in a heap on the marble floor, and Ned and Lars straddled their bodies. They looked down on them with nothing in their faces and fired into their bodies until their corpses jumped.
"Detective." She closed the door behind her. "I'd been wondering if you'd come back for that. I was about to call your cell."
He fell into step behind her as she walked to the elevators.
"Heading out?"
She looked back over her left shoulder at him. Brian, Sebastian, and 2 ex-boyfriends had all told her it was her sexiest look. She could see it scored with Trayvon Kessler by the way he blinked at it, as if to deflect it from landing.
"Just trying to walk off the buzz."
"Isn't sleep for that?"
"Can I come clean on something? A secret?"
"I love secrets. Why, I'm a cop."
They reached the elevator bank. She pressed down and risked a glance back up the corridor to her apartment door. What would she do if the door opened? Run for the stairs? They'd just kill her in the stairwell. "I'm a closet smoker," she said, "and I ran out."
"Ah."
He nodded several times.
"I bet he knows."
"Hmm?"
"Your husband. I bet he knows you smoke, but he chooses not to let on. Where's Mr. Perloff?"
"Passed out on the living room couch."
"I'm sure your husband's cool with that, too. Another man sleeping over. He's progressive that way, your husband. Nothing antiquated about old Brian."
She looked at the numbers above the left elevator and saw the car was stalled on 3, looked at the numbers on the right elevator and saw nothing was lit up. They'd shut it down for the night. It was probably on a timer to save energy costs.
"Fucking timers," she thought, and looked back at her door.
"You expect it to move?"
Trayvon Kessler asked.
"What's that?"
"Your door. You keep looking back at it."
If Ned and Lars walked out now, guns drawn, they'd have the drop on Kessler. But if she told him they were in there, told him what they'd done, he'd pull his gun, shield her with his body, and call for the cavalry. And this nightmare would be over. All she had to do was tell him, and prepare herself for jail.
"Do I? I'm not myself right now."
"Was that?"
"Learning my husband is living a double life could have affected me a bit."
"There's that."
He looked above the elevator.
"Should we take the stairs?"
She didn't give it a thought.
"Sure."
"No, wait, it's moving."
The elevator car crawled from 3 to 4 and then picked up speed and shot from 4 to 5 to 6 to 7 to 8 to 9 and stopped. She looked at Kessler. He gave her a "sue me" shrug. She said,
"I'm taking the stairs,"
and turned toward them.
"It's moving again."
The red light jumped from 9 to 10 and then zipped from 11 to 14 and stopped again. She could hear laughter from the shaft, the people getting off on 14 sounding Saturday night drunk on a Tuesday. Trayvon Kessler had his back to the corridor when Ned stepped out of her apartment. She thought of screaming. She thought of running for the stairs, the red exit sign beckoning like the hand of God. By the time Kessler followed her gaze and turned, Ned had strolled up the corridor to them, his hands free, the gun probably tucked at the small of his back, hidden by the hem of his members-only jacket.
"Rachel,"
he said.
"Haven't seen you in a while."
"Ned?"
She watched a quick flare of confusion in his eyes. "Been staying home, mostly, ordering in." Ned turned to Detective Kessler.
"Ned Hempel."
He stuck out his hand.
"Trayvon Kessler. What brings the Providence police to Boston?"
Kessler looked confused for a moment, until he glanced down at his own belt, saw the gold badge clipped there.
Checking out a few leads.
The elevator dinged as the car arrived and the doors opened. They got in. Kessler pressed L. Chapter 26 Mouthpiece.
Is everything okay, Rachel?
Ned looked across the car at her, his face the picture of concern.
Sure. Why?
Well, I just...
He looked embarrassed as he turned to Trayvon Kessler.
I live next door to Rachel and Brian. Sorry, I should keep my big mouth shut.
Kessler gave that a loose grin.
Should he keep his mouth shut, Rachel?
Not on my account.
Kessler held out his hand.
Proceed, Mr. Hempel.
Ned hemmed and hawed and looked at his shoes for a moment.
I heard some... shouting a few minutes ago. I guess you and Brian aren't getting along. Same thing happens with me and Rosemary. No big deal. I just hope everything's okay. Shouting?
Kessler's grin grew broader.
People fight,
Ned said.
Oh, I know people fight,
Kessler said.
I'm just surprised Rachel was fighting with Brian. Only a few minutes ago, huh?
The car stopped at 7, and Mr. Cornelius, who owned 3 nightclubs in the Fenway, got on. He gave them all a polite smile and went back to texting someone on his phone. Ned had served her up to Kessler on a platter. Even if she managed to get away from both of them when they reached the lobby, and she had no idea how she'd manage that, Kessler would go back to her apartment, this time with a warrant, and find Caleb dead inside. Not passed out, dead. She realized they were both looking at her, awaiting a response.
It wasn't Brian, Ned, thank you.
No?
It was his partner. You've met him a few times. Caleb?
Ned nodded.
Good-looking fella.
That's him.
Ned said to Kessler,
Like I'm always telling the wife, though. Looks fade.
Rachel said, He wanted to drive home, and I didn't want to let him. Too much bourbon. Kessler said,
But he took the tea.
What?
Over from Cambridge. He told us he took the subway.
But he lives in the seaport, and he didn't want to take the tea back there. He wanted to borrow my car. That's what the fight was about.
Jesus, how many fucking details could she keep straight here?
Ah, makes sense,
Ned said in a tone suggesting that it didn't.
Why wouldn't he just take a cab?
Kessler said.
Uber,
Ned ventured.
What he said.
Kessler jerked his thumb at Ned.
You'll have to ask him when he sobers up, she said.
Now Mr. Cornelius was watching the three of them, not sure what was going on, but recognizing conflict when it was in front of his face. They reached the lobby. The moment they exited the building, Kessler would, she presumed, leave her. Even if she stalled, chatted Kessler up on the sidewalk, Ned would just act as if he'd walked away, and the moment Kessler did, in fact, drive off, Ned would reappear, or just shoot her from across the street. She placed her hand up to the back of her neck, fingered the clasp of her necklace. If she could twist it a bit, and then snap her fingers, she might be able to break the strand. The beads would hit the floor. The men would bend to retrieve them, and she could scoot out through the mail room.
Got a bite?
Kessler asked.
What?
An itch, he said. Is your neck itchy?
Now Ned was looking at her. She dropped her hand.
Yeah, a little bit.
They walked into the lobby. Mr. Cornelius turned right into the hall for the garage elevators. Ned and Kessler kept moving forward. Dominic, behind the desk, glanced up at them, seemed mildly baffled by the presence of Kessler and Ned, but he gave Rachel a nod and went back to his magazine.
No garage? She asked Ned.
Hmm?
Ned followed her gaze to the garage door.
No.
You're parked out on the street? She said.
Ned looked back over his shoulder at her.
Oh, no, I'm just going out for a walk, dear. Everyone's going for a walk tonight,
Kessler said. He patted his stomach.
Makes me feel like I gotta hit the gym.
He opened the front door inward and made an after-you gesture to them both. Ned went through the door, followed by Rachel. On the sidewalk, Rachel said to Ned, "Enjoy your walk. Tell Rosemary I said hi."
"Will do."
Ned stretched out his hand to Kessler.
"Nice to meet you, Detective. You too, Mr. Temple."
"Hempel," Ned said, shaking his hand.
"Of course. My bad."
Kessler dropped his hand.
"Take care, sir."
For an odd few seconds, none of them moved. Eventually, Ned turned and headed east along the sidewalk, his hands in his pockets. Rachel glanced over at Detective Kessler, who seemed to be waiting on something. When she looked back down the darkened street, Ned was nowhere to be seen.
"So that's Ned."
"That's Ned."
"He and Rosemary been married a long time?"
"Ages."
"No wedding ring, though. He didn't strike me as the bohemian type, thinks rings are just symbols of societal oppression from the dominant paradigm."
"Probably just in for a cleaning."
"That could be it,"
he said.
"What's he do, our friend Ned?"
"You know, I'm not sure."
"Why am I not surprised?"
"Some kind of manufacturing, I think."
"Manufacturing?"
Kessler said.
"We don't make shit in this country anymore."
She shrugged. "You know how it is with neighbors these days."
"Oh, do tell."
"Everyone guards their privacy." She gave him a tight smile. He opened the passenger door to a dark four-door Ford.
"Let me give you a ride to get your cigarettes."
She looked back down the street. Every 20 feet was a pool of light cast by the street lamps. In between those lights lay the dark.
"Sure."
She got in the car. Kessler got in, put his hat between them on the seat, and pulled away from the curb.
"I've been on some fucked up cases, if you'll excuse my language, but this is one of the more fucked up ones I've been on of late. I got a dead blonde in Rhodey, a missing guy leading a double life, his lying wife."
"I'm not lying."
"Oh, ho."
He wagged a finger at her.
"Yes, yes, yes you are, Mrs. Delacroix. You're telling so many lies I can't even count them. And your neighbor there, the married guy in the members-only jacket and the JCPenney slacks without the wedding ring, guys like him don't live in buildings like yours. He didn't even know where the fucking garage was, and the doorman had clearly never seen him before."
"I didn't notice."
"Lucky I'm a cop. They fucking pay us to notice shit like that."
"You say fuck a lot."
"And why not?"
he said.
"It's a great word. Verb, noun, adverb, adjective. Fuck is fucking util."
He turned left.
"My problem with your lying is that I don't know why or what you're lying about. It's still too early in the case. But man, do I know you're lying."
They stopped at a light, and she felt certain Ned was going to appear by Kessler's window and start firing into the car. The light turned green, and Kessler took another left and parked outside the Tedeschi's on Boylston, across the street from the Prudential. He turned in the seat toward her, and all the hard mirth left his eyes, and what replaced it was something she couldn't identify.
"The late Nicole Alden,"
he said,
"was executed. As professional a hit as I've ever seen, and I've seen a few. So your husband with the double life? There's a good chance he's a pro at, you know, ending lives. And either him or some of his friends may come a-calling. And Rachel?"
He leaned across the seat, close enough that she could smell the Altoids.
"They will fucking execute you."
He couldn't save her. Even if he was interested and she doubted he was. His job was to close the Nicole Alden murder. He'd decided, with a cop's narrow certitude, that the best way to do that was to pin the murder on Brian. But when Brian didn't turn back up, Kessler would dig deeper. Maybe he'd find out she'd been in Providence just before the victim was killed. Zip cars, she was fairly certain, had tracking devices on them so the company always knew where their cars were. Wouldn't take much to put Rachel on that street outside Nicole Alden's house. And then the scenario was easy to see. Wife discovers husband has another wife with a baby on the way to boot and kills her. And if that scenario wasn't damning enough, there was the dead body of her husband's business partner sitting up in her apartment. And a coroner's examination would prove said partner was dead prior to Rachel claiming to this very police officer that he was alive and well and passed out on her couch.
"I don't like being bullied," she told Detective Kessler.
"I'm not bullying you. I'm stating facts."
"You're stating conjecture, in the most threatening manner possible."
"It's not conjecture,"
he said.
"To notice you're terrified right now."
"I've been terrified before."
He shook his head slowly, this tough cop looking at this entitled yuppie without a day job. Probably pictured her walk-in closet full of high-end workout clothes, Louboutin heels, silk business suits she wore to restaurants no cop could afford.
"You think you have, but you haven't. There's darkness in this world you can't learn about watching TV and reading books."
That night, at the camp in Laogan, the men strode back and forth through the mud and the heat in the light of the trash can fires, serpettes and bottles of cheap liquor in hand. Around 2 in the morning, Witty said to her,
"If I let them have me now, they may only..."
She made a circle with one hand and drove the index finger of the other hand in and out of the circle several times.
"But if we make them wait, they may grow angry and..."
She drew the same finger across her throat. Witty, Witteline Jean Calixte was her full name, was 11 years old. Rachel had convinced her to stay hidden. But, as Witty had predicted, all that did was make the men angrier, and a short time after sunup, they had found her. Found them both.
"I know a little bit about the darkness in this world," Rachel told Trayvon Kessler.
"Yeah?"
His eyes searched hers.
"Yeah."
"And what have you learned?"
he whispered. "If you wait for it to find you, you're already dead." She got out of the car. When she came around to the sidewalk, he'd rolled down his window.
"You planning on giving me the slip?"
She smiled.
"Yes."
"I'm a cop. Kinda good at keeping people in my sights."
"But you're from Providence, and this is Boston."
He acknowledged that with a slight tilt of his head.
"Next time you see me then, Mrs. Delacroix, I'll have a search warrant in my hand."
"Fair enough."
She walked up the sidewalk as he pulled away. She didn't even pretend to walk into the store, just watched Kessler turn right at the next corner before she crossed Boylston to the cab stand in front of a hotel. She hopped into the back of the first cab and told the driver to head for the marina at Port Norfolk. The parking lot at the marina was empty, so she had the driver wait a few minutes to see if anyone had followed her, but the entire neighborhood was gone to bed, so quiet you could hear the boats bump against their slips and the old wood buildings creak in the night breeze. Back on the boat, she went into the galley, turned on the lights, and pulled the keys out of the drawer where she'd left them when they'd tied the boat off. She untied the ropes next, and then motored out into the harbor, running lights on full. 20 minutes later, she could see Thompson Island appear in the starlight, and a minute after that, she reached the minuscule island with the one bent tree. She went back into the galley, and this go-round, with the luxury of time, she found the scuba gear, mask, flippers, oxygen tank. She rummaged around a little more and found another flashlight and a wetsuit. Woman's medium, belonging, she presumed, to the late Nicole Alden. She changed into the suit, donned the oxygen tank, flippers, and mask, and returned with the flashlight to the stern. She took her seat on the gunwale and looked up at the sky. The cloud bank from earlier had moved on, and the stars arrayed themselves in clusters, as if seeking the protection of the herd, and she felt them not as celestial things, as gods or the servants of gods, but as cast-offs, exiles, lost in the vast ink sky. What appeared as clusters down here were, up there, fields 1,000,000 miles wide. The closest stars were light-years apart, no closer to one another than she was to a tribeswoman of the Saharan steppe in the 15th century. "If we are this alone," she wanted to know, Then what is the point? And she tipped back and fell through the ocean. She turned on her flashlight and soon discerned the one she'd dropped. It winked up at her from the floor of the bay. As she descended, she saw that it had landed in the sand about 20 yards from the boulder where Brian lay. She trained her light on the top of the boulder and moved the shaft down and down some more until she reached the sand. There was no body there. So she'd gotten the boulders mixed up. She turned her beam to the left and saw another boulder about 20 yards away. She swam halfway to it, but then grew certain it was the wrong shape and color. She'd left Brian against a tall, conical rock, just like the one she'd landed near. She swam back, moving her flashlight continually left and then right, then farther left, then farther right. No boulders that looked anything like the one where she'd left him, the one in front of which she now floated. This was the boulder where she'd left him. She was sure of it. She could tell by the depth of its craters and the conical shape. Had he been carried off by the current? Or worse, a shark? She kicked her way over to exactly where she'd last seen him. She checked the sand for signs of indentation, an impression of his legs or buttocks, but it had been worn smooth by the water. She caught a glimpse of black that was blacker than the boulder. It was just a flicker of it, like a flaking of skin along the left edge of the rock. She kicked to her left and shone her light around the corner, and at first she saw nothing. But then she saw everything. It was a mouthpiece. She swam around to the back of the rock. The mouthpiece was attached to a tube that was attached to an oxygen tank. She looked back up through the dark water to the hull of the boat. "You're alive." She kicked for the surface. "Until I find you." Chapter 27 It She motored out to Thompson Island and found the dock within 400 yards of where Brian had fallen in. There was no boat there, of course. Whatever boat had been there was long gone, and he was on it. She had to wait a long time for the cab. It was 4 in the morning, and the dispatcher didn't know where the Point Norfolk Marina was. She heard him tap his computer keyboard for about 30 minutes before he grumbled, 20 minutes, into the phone and hung up. She stood in the dark parking lot and imagined all the things that could be going wrong right now. Trayvon Kessler could have gotten his warrant. No, Rachel, he'd have to go back to Providence, find a judge, deal with jurisdiction issues, maybe by sunup, but probably not even then. Breathe. Breathe. Breathe? Brian was alive. Ned had shot Caleb in the face. She could see the older man's face as he did it, lupine somehow, wholly comfortable with predatory dominance. He'd looked at a fellow human being sitting 4 feet away from him and killed that human being as easily as a hawk would spear a chipmunk with its talons. There was no pleasure to be had in the killing for Ned, but no regret either. Brian was out there, eluding her. Alive. Had she always known somewhere deep in her lizard brain that he'd never died? But vengeance on Brian was, at this immediate moment as she stood in an empty parking lot at the witching hour, a luxury. Ned and Lars were out there, hunting her. Smartphones could be hacked, turned quite easily into tracking devices and listening devices for hostile parties or government snoops. If Ned or Lars knew how to hack into hers, they'd know where she was. Headlights appeared 200 yards away, at the beginning of the rutted street that led from the edge of Tinian Beach to here. The two lights bounced and canted and glowed brighter as they neared. Could be a cab. Could be Ned. She wrapped her hand around the gun in her bag, the gun her husband had tried to kill her with, or acted as if he were trying to kill her. She wrapped her finger around the trigger and thumbed off the safety, even as it occurred to her that it wouldn't matter. If the car belonged to Ned and Lars, they could just accelerate at the last possible second and run her over. Not a thing she could do about it. The headlights swept the parking lot, and the car turned in an arc to pull in front of her. It was brown and white and had Boston Cab painted on the doors. The driver was a middle-aged white woman with a beige afro. Rachel climbed in, and they pulled out of the marina. She had the cab drop her 2 blocks south of her apartment and walked up through an alley as a false dawn grayed the lower edges of the sky. She crossed Fairfield and walked down the ramp to the garage grate. She entered her code in the keypad to the right of the grate, and the grate rose, and she entered the garage. She took the elevator to 11, got out, and walked up the stairs to 15. Soon she stood outside her door. This was the step she'd agonized over. If either Ned or Lars had remained behind, she was dead as soon as she entered the apartment. But if, no, when Trayvon Kessler returned with that warrant and broke down this door, she needed to know what he'd find on the other side. The ride back from the bay to the marina, she'd debated if it was worth the risk and decided that Ned and Lars would assume she'd never return. It made no sense. Then again, she mused as she stood outside the door with the key in her hand, maybe they were counting on her to do the stupid thing. She had no experience dealing with people like them, but they had plenty of experience dealing with rubes like her. On the other side of that door was either death or knowledge, plus a stash of cash Brian kept in a floor safe. Not much, a couple thousand, but enough to run on if Kessler had already taken the step of shutting down her credit cards. She doubted, on one hand, that he had the power to do so, but then, on the other, what did she know about police procedure when dealing with a murder suspect? And by now, that's what she could be, a murder suspect. By mid-morning, she could be a suspect in 2 murders. She looked at the lock, at the key in her hand. She took a breath. Her hand shook when she raised it, so she lowered it again. Took several more breaths. Brian was alive. Brian had put her in this situation. Somehow, some way, she was going to find him and make him pay. Or she was going to die in the next 30 seconds. She inserted the key in the lock, but she didn't turn it. She imagined a fusillade of bullets punching through the door and into her head, neck, and chest. She closed her eyes and tried to will herself to turn the key, turn the key. But once she did, the only step to take would be forward, into the apartment. And she wasn't ready. She wasn't. If they were on the other side, and if they were close enough to the door to have heard her insert the key, they could simply shoot her through the door. But just because they hadn't didn't mean they weren't in there. They could be waiting patiently on the other side of the door, exchanging glances, maybe even smirks, screwing their silencers onto their pistols, taking careful aim at the doorway and waiting for the moment when she opened the door. She'd wait them out. If they were in there, they'd heard the key enter the lock. Sooner or later, if she didn't enter, they'd open the door. Then again, Rachel, you dumb fuck, they could be watching you through the spy hole right now. She stepped to the right of the door, pulled the pistol from her bag, thumbed off the safety yet again. Waited. She waited 5 minutes. Felt like 50. Checked her watch again. Nope. 5. In some time continuum, we're all dead as soon as we're born. By that logic, she was long dead somewhere, looking back through the portals of time at this very moment and smiling at all the fuss corporeal Rachel was putting herself through. I'm already dead, she assured herself. She turned the key in the lock and threw the door open, the gun pointing straight into the apartment, completely useless if either Lars or Ned was to her right or her left. They weren't. Caleb still sat at the table, his flesh the white of soap, the blood crusted and black in the center of his face. She closed the door behind her and moved to her right, inching down the wall until she reached the open doorway of the half-bath. It appeared empty. She looked in the crack between the open door and the jamb and saw that no one was hiding on the other side. She moved toward the bedroom. The door was closed. She put her palm on the handle, but her flesh was so slick with sweat it slid off. She wiped it on her pants, used her sleeve to wipe the door handle, grasped it with her left hand, held the gun in her right, swung the door inward. As she did, she imagined Lars sitting on her bed waiting for her. A soft pop and she'd be on her back, leaking. He wasn't there. The room appeared empty. But it reinforced what she'd felt entering the apartment. They were better at this than she was. If they were in here with her, she was already dead. She entered the master bathroom, and then checked the his and her walk-in closets with a sudden fatalism. She felt closer to death